Welcome to the APCDA podcast. This is your host, Ruchira Tripathi, and you're listening to the Voice of Industry. Supply chains support modern life. I don't think any of us gave a thought to how products get made or how they reach us before the pandemic hit. I certainly didn't. In the early days of the pandemic, there was a shortage of consumer products. And I remember going to the supermarket at 5 a.m. to get a better shot at finding products on shelves. Then came the chip shortages as we started working from home and needed laptops. And more recently, we had the food grain and oil shortages because of the Ukrainian war. The disruption in supply chain has directly impacted us as an end consumer. And I don't remember any of the previous global events hitting so close to home. So what has changed? Today, I'm with Sharath Ram Santanam. Sharath is the head of supply chain at Evidence Scientific and has also held roles at multinationals such as Suez Water Technologies, which is now under Veolia, and Nalco, now under Ecolab. We will talk about global supply chain crisis, developments taking place in the supply chain function, and the changing face of future talent. Please note that the views expressed on the podcast are that of my guest and are not reflective of the organization. Welcome, Sharath.
Thanks, Ruchi. Thanks for the introduction. Happy to be here on your podcast. My privilege.
Before we get on with the topic, I would like the listeners to get a flavor of you. Could you share with us your background and how you got into supply chain?
Okay, so as you said, I'm currently the head of supply chain for APAC at Evidence Scientific. Evidence Scientific is a world leader in life solutions, in solutions for life science and industrial markets, and I'm based out of Singapore. Been in supply chain for 17 years, got a lot of end-to-end supply chain experience, and I worked in various roles in supply chain, and held individual roles and obviously regional leadership roles as well. I started as a planner in a factory with Cameron Singapore, an oil and gas equipment manufacturer, which is now part of Schlumberger. I did a small stint in ABB as a logistics analyst, and I went overseas to Oman, where I worked with Cameron again in Oman. I came back to Singapore, as you said. I worked with Nalco, which is now Ecolab, and then I moved on to what was then called GE Water, which then became Suez Water Technologies and Solution, and now it's called Veolia Water Technologies and Solution. So I spent just about 10 years there and started as an individual contributor and then progressed to operations leadership roles and regional leadership roles. And in March 2022, I moved into my current role to help set up the APAC supply chain for Evident. Evident was previously called the Scientific Solutions Division of Olympus. Olympus decided to spin off the organization, and set up as a separate company. So to your question of how I ended up in supply chain, I think that was I had finished my engineering in India, and after 4 years of doing engineering, I realized I didn't really like engineering to make it a career. And I started to look out on what other areas that would pique my interest or which I would like to work in. So I spoke to a few people. One of them pointed me in the direction of supply chain. I read about it. I liked what I read. And he said, well, go to Singapore to study supply chain or go to the US. And I felt Singapore was a lot closer. Being in India at the time, Singapore just felt a lot closer. It was only a four and a five hour flight away rather than going to the US. So I ended up in Singapore. I did my master's in supply chain in logistics from NTU. Nanyang Technological University, and then I started working from there in supply chain, and I've stayed in supply chain ever since. In the last, so it's been about 17 years now. Yep.
So talking about basics first, I mean, what is supply chain? Could you explain a little bit to like people like me?
Supply chain essentially, you know, keeping in mind the audience that's going to listen to this podcast, supply chain essentially is a network of operations which helps bring products to shelves, right? Or bring products from a manufacturer to a customer. That's what supply chain essentially is. Of course, there are lots of different components in supply chain. You know, it's you have the procurement part where you go and buy materials that are necessary for the products that you make. You've got the planning part where you decide how much material you need to buy. You've got to think about the sales, how much revenue and sales the company is deciding to make, how much you've historically sold. You've got the quality part where quality checks the quality of the products you make, whether it's something that will pass the requirements, the quality standard of the company and the customer's requirements as well. You've got the customer service part where orders are taken in, orders are entered, orders are processed, right? And any customer inquiries are attended to. And you've got the logistics part, which is the critical part where materials end up being put on a shelf or delivered to the customer. It also includes reverse logistics where, you know, if you don't like a product as a customer, you want to return it to the manufacturer or to the supplier. Reverse logistics is the part where the products get returned back to whoever sold it to you, right? You also have the trade compliance area in supply chain, which looks after compliance in supply chain, such as customs compliance, making sure you pay the right duties and taxes whenever you import or whenever you export a part. Yeah. And in some companies, you have regulatory affairs, which are also part of the broader supply chain.
Okay. So if I talk about, you know, some of the conversations or the news items around the supply chain space, you know, ever since the pandemic started and more recently, you know, the Ukrainian war, we keep talking about like something called the global supply chain crisis and that, you know, these events have kind of exposed vulnerabilities in the global supply chain. And even now they are saying that companies are being faced with disruptions. So what are these vulnerabilities and what's happening? I mean, why are we not able to stabilize the chain?
See, the main vulnerabilities in any supply chain are operational, financial, geopolitical risks, and also the reputation of the company, right? Now, for years, with the growth of globalization, companies have taken global supply chains for granted. As you said at the beginning of the podcast, you never paid too much thought about how did a certain product get on the shelf. But then when COVID hit, you realized that, hey, you had to go at 5 a.m. to look for products. Now, as I said, for years, having suppliers and manufacturing different continents, mainly in Asia or Mexico or Eastern Europe, in pursuit of low cost and shipping it to markets across the world was very normal. And these arrangements were very reliable. So companies started to keep very low inventories, you know, because it helps the companies improve their cash flow. Supply chains were a beacon of stability, even during financial crisis. When we had the 2008-2009 financial crisis, the stores didn't run out of stock of products. Now, the Ukrainian war has predominantly affected food supply chains, but to me, the COVID pandemic was the real big crisis that impacted global supply chains, irrespective of industry. Lockdowns made it very difficult to move goods across the world. Companies that had a lot of dependencies on Asia, particularly China, were quite badly affected as manufacturing stalled and economic activity practically ground to a halt. Now, even in countries where the lockdowns weren't stringent, high infection rates led to a huge shortage of staff at workplaces. Companies couldn't operate full shifts as the workers were infected, and this affected the output. This not only affected the front lines, such as manufacturing or logistics, but even other cogs in the supply chain, which people don't really see, things that happen in the background, they were also affected. For example, if you want to import something, you need an import permit, but companies were stuck in situations where they couldn't get an import permit because the customs department had called in sick. There were nobody in the customs department or the regulators or the government bodies to process these permits. So we had situations where, personally, I've experienced situations where cargoes were stuck in the ship, or the ship couldn't even berth into the ports, and we couldn't get the goods off the vessels. And when things started to clear, congestions were commonplace and vessels were just lined up. And I remember going out to East Coast in Singapore and seeing a row of vessels just lined up because there were just no space in the ports for the vessels to berth, right? And so what happened was companies that had pursued a strategy of having very low inventories or operated on a very tight just-in-time policy were unable to refill their inventories on time, which led to the situation that you faced, which is not having stock on the shelves, not having enough stock on the shelves, right? So this affected the company's commitments to the customers, it affected revenues, and also importantly, the reputations. I remember reading in one of the articles that in the US, about close to between 65 to 70% of the customers shifted loyalty because at that time, especially during COVID, what they needed was they needed what they wanted. They needed the products, and they didn't care whether it was your favorite brand that made it. As long as something was available on the shelf, they took it. And now what happens is these customers, once they get used to the fact that their favorite brand A is not on the shelf, but brand B regularly is able to get stuff on the shelf. It may not be as good as brand A, but hey, I've got something that I need, whereas brand A doesn't have it. So companies start to lose the customers, they lose their loyalty as well, right? So, and also changing regulations during lockdowns, there were a lot of lack of clarity from authorities. It affected any plans that the supply chain teams had worked out. So this is where, you know, we mentioned about how COVID greatly affected supply chains across the world. And this was the operational vulnerability we talked about. Now, because there's an operational vulnerability and you don't put stock on the shelves, goods are not received by the customers, so customers are not going to pay you, right? So companies aren't able to hit the revenues targets that they had. So it affects the financials. Having stocks, you know, stuck in the ports and the vessels and the containers, not able to clear containers or, you know, from the port, adds a lot of other charges like demurrage and detention charges on the freight side, which also companies have to pay. And that affects that increases their costs and affects their profit margins. Yeah. And the other risks are like geopolitical risks, as I mentioned, you know, and where they have trade wars and you have tariffs being raised, or like the Ukrainian war as well, which means that you can't really have any supply through Ukraine. You can't have, the ports are closed around that, your vessels or flights have to take a different route, so that increases your freight costs as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Having said that, you know, when you talk about the impact of these vulnerabilities, we should also talk about what the companies are doing to manage these impacts, right? So the pandemic tested the existing supply chain model. This is not to say that the global supply chain model, as we've known it, is irrelevant. It just made the pandemic made companies rethink their supply chain and calibrate their models. So we had brought to the fore the concept of supply chain risk management, supply chain resilience and agility. Companies that understood this very quickly evaluated this and started to focus on improving their resilience and diversifying the risk. It could be through simple steps such as increasing some strategic inventory and not keeping the inventory too lean. Companies, some other forward-thinking leadership at certain companies, they took steps to evaluate their entire model and reduce the risk by diversifying their supplier pool or practicing nearshoring, which is the concept of bringing suppliers closer to your key markets. Now, for example, if your key market is the US, they might want to bring more suppliers in Mexico, right? Or even some countries, in some cases, companies decided to manufacture in their home countries, even though the costs were higher. It's called reshoring. Yeah,
I understand that some of the companies are actually still facing disruptions. I mean, we are kind of out of the pandemic. So is there a reason why we are not able to stabilize the chain now? I mean, what's going on now? The things have not gone back to normal for the supply chain, the global supply chain.
Yeah. So during the pandemic, I think it affected a lot of different industries. Now, as you mentioned earlier on, you have the chips shortage. So that's affecting industries that rely on these chips. So it's not as broad or, you know, as it was during the pandemic. It's very specific now. And again, in some cases, I know personally that some of these companies have kept their supplier base too lean, for example, if they have, right? And that's potentially one reason. And the other reason is also, as I said, there is just a huge demand. And this, even if they increase the supplier base, there's just so much demand that there's not enough, capacity to meet that demand.
Okay, you were talking about low inventory and just in time. And I understand that there are companies that are kind of moving away from, the just in time kind of manufacturing or supply chain strategy to a mix between just in time and what they call just in case, where they actually stockpile. And in addition to that, for some of the other companies, I understand that they have even flipped the supply chain, meaning that, the stable and high volume products that they were making in-house, they have now started outsourcing it to their contract manufacturers, while the niche and the special products that they were giving to these contract manufacturers on a, need basis, now they are making it in-house so that they can, keep control of customer satisfaction and respond rapidly to the changing demands. Have you observed something like this in your organization as well, or maybe in some of the other organization? What's your view on this?
Well, we all know about just in time. Just in time is a very age-old strategy. It started from the 60s, with the concepts of lean manufacturing and so on. Just in case is probably a newfangled word for what has been a very traditional risk management method in supply chain. Now, what is just, you said just in case is stockpiling. I mean, frankly, this is the first time I'm hearing that term, right? When you say just in case is stockpiling, I would beg to differ. I would say that any good supply chain strategy, even if you're doing just in time, you should probably have a certain degree of safety stock, right? To cater for any variabilities in demand or lead time or crises. And obviously, if there are businesses that haven't done that and ran their safety stock so low that they just had enough to cover for a very short period, and if the supply chains haven't recovered in that short period, then they've run out of stock, and that's why they can put stuff on the shelves. So I don't think just in case is anything new. I think it's just a return to the basics of having strategic safety stock. Now, I don't, by strategic safety stock, I mean as companies start to evaluate their supply chains, they evaluate the risks in their supply chain. They might see that there's a certain product where they feel, well, if an event happens, if a crisis happens, we can't respond within a certain degree of time. So then we would have to keep some amount of strategic inventory. How and where they keep it, that's all, again, has to be evaluated depending on their market and their business, right? So to me, it's just a return to the fundamentals of supply chain, of evaluating your risks, having the right inventory, the right levels of safety stock, setting the right reorder points, having the right operating rhythms and cycles of managing your inventory. That's how I'd say, that's probably what just in case is. It's a newfangled term. I'll probably go and read up more about it, but I don't think it's any different just based on what you're saying. Yeah. Now, on your other question of flipping the supply chain, well, my organization predominantly makes everything in-house because our products are generally very niche, so I can probably understand why companies would want to make their niche products in-house. And there are, other than the fact that it's niche and that it's intellectual property, there is customer satisfaction. Those are probably their flagship products and things like that. There are many business reasons for wanting to do it in-house. It also makes sense if some of these stable products, so-called stable products, are made externally. Of course, factors to consider in doing so would be the complexity. Is it very niche? Is there an IP issue there? Or if there's an IP issue, what sort of risks are we talking about? Can we cover those risks legally through strong arrangements with our suppliers? It's it's something that does make sense, but I've not seen that in my organization or in other organizations that I've worked in. Yeah.
Okay. You were talking about geopolitical tensions a little bit earlier. So, I mean, we all know that there's been a rise in economic nationalism, geopolitical tension, and there are mega trends that, you know, some of these consultants are talking about, like urbanization, social demographic change, and of course we have climate change. So all these are there on one side. And then on the other side, you have the continued expectation of low prices by consumers. So how are global supply chains being reconfigured to address these issues and at the same time keep the customer satisfied?
Well, geopolitical tensions and economic nationalism have always been there. But in the current world, it's magnified now because of the tensions between the two major economic powers, the US and China. Obviously, this has a big impact on supply chains as it hits at the fundamental driver of a global supply chain, which is global trade, right? Global supply chains evolved with the rise in globalization. If you take, for example, a few years back during the Trump regime, there were trade wars between the two countries. There were tit-for-tat tariffs being imposed on a variety of products. This raised production costs in both the countries, and sometimes sluggish economic growth, especially, you know, if the economic activity globally is sluggish, countries may force, you know, it may force the government to raise import tariffs or put in excess additional duties or taxes to protect their local, you know, companies and jobs. So this will naturally raise the cost of doing businesses in these countries. Now, again, these are actions that sometimes a lot of companies may not have enough, you know, leverage to do anything about. Of course, there's lobbying. Companies do actively, company confederations, industry bodies do speak to the governments on these kind of measures. But companies would have to do what they have to do to help manage the cost, right? Of course, you can't always keep all the costs low. Some costs will be eventually passed on to consumers, as we're seeing now in an era of high inflation. So what can companies do to keep costs low? So again, one, there are multiple levers. You can try and diversify the supplier pool to see if you can source the same products or equivalent products from a non-restricted source. By non-restricted, I mean there are no import tariffs, for example, by importing from country B versus country A, right? Of course, if the product is niche or there's a proprietary arrangement around it, it adds to the pressure. So there are companies may look at other strategic levers to keep costs at par. And there'll be a greater focus on operational excellence to take costs out of the production process. There'll be focus on digitalization and automation, right? And investing in digital supply chains becomes more critical because we need a lot of in-depth data and analytics to extract every dollar and cent out of the cost, every dollar and cent of cost out of the process. Yeah. So these are some of the ways that companies can try and, you know, keep costs in control, right? I know from experience that usually what happens in these cases is it's not just costs that are kept in control. There's always the other aspect of companies trying to protect margins because essentially that relates to profitability. So both actions, both cost actions as well as price increase actions, will be taken in tandem. So it's not entirely possible to keep prices low all the time. I mean, of course, again, it depends, right? It depends on the company, it depends on the volume, it depends on what sort of industry you're in.
Okay. So we'll change gears a little bit, Sharat. We're going to talk about talent and emerging careers, because the listeners of the podcast are going to be career practitioners who work with young people, who work with, you know, job seekers. So I want to talk about that also a little bit. Given the changes that are taking place in the world of work and also in the supply chain industry, what kind of roles do you think will emerge in the future? I mean, are you already seeing some kind of roles within the function, the supply chain function, that are emerging that you would want to highlight, perhaps?
Yeah. So I prefer to think that, you know, roles in supply chain generally might, or the nature of the type of roles or the titles, if you will, can remain the same, but the nature of work they may do will be different. Now, for example, if you see in most industries, we're seeing automation take away a lot of the administrative tasks, for example, right? Now, take a company which is essentially a small, medium enterprise, and they may have a few planners with, and they may have a basic ERP system, and they may not have very high levels of automation. Take a company like that. Now, in this case, the planners would also, aside from doing the normal, the planning work, they would also have a lot of administrative tasks, data entry tasks, and reporting duties, which they will have to do, right? Now, if this company decides to make a significant investment in upgrading their systems and scale up automation dramatically, the administrative reporting and analytics, all of that gets taken away from the planners. It gets done by the system. So the role of the planners will change to one from where they are doing things to one where they are focused on interpreting data, right? Understanding the data, understanding the analytics, doing scenario planning, for example. For example, scenario one is your stable scenario. So how does my production look like in a stable scenario? Scenario two is a disruption to a certain raw material. How does it look like? So all these analytics can be done by the systems, where in the past planners would have to manually do it. Now all these analytics could be done by the system. So they have to take that information, digest it, and transform them into proper insights into the supply chain processes. So the role will change. Again, we can talk about logistics. So a lot of warehouses are getting automated nowadays, especially in Singapore. Singapore is a logistics hub, but sometimes we do find a difficulty in having skilled workers, for example, right? So what can we potentially do? Companies can automate their warehouses. We're seeing a lot of, you know, warehouse automation, robots being used in warehouse. Amazon's a great example of using robots throughout their warehouses. And so in the past where a worker in the warehouse had to go to a rack to retrieve a product, now you have the product coming to the workstation where the worker is. So that changes the type of roles that will be available, right? As supply chains become more data-driven, companies pursue digitalization, automation, you know. Master data management is an area that assumes an increasing importance, right? It's a fallacy to assume that implementation of systems and data capture methods will lead to a more data-driven supply chain, but without proper master data management. So a lot of companies I can see right now are hiring for master data experts. They're hiring for master data management teams. They're building master data management teams where a proper team of master data managers and, you know, specialists working under a team, right? So again, there are different companies have different strategies of how to house these teams. And in some companies, this may be under IT. In some companies, these roles are within the supply chain function simply because supply chain handles large volumes of data across the board. You handle volume, you know, you see data through the manufacturing system, especially if you have a manufacturing supply chain, you have so much data being fed back from the machines, you know, through, if your machines are all wired up and through the Internet of Things and things like that, there's just so much data available. So you need a proper team to make sense of all this data. Yeah. So as I said, some roles may disappear due to automation, as we see in most industries, but some of the other roles that are the backbone of supply chain, such as planning, you know, for example, the nature of the role will change. And the number of people being employed in that will also probably change because tasks get automated.
And what do you think are skills and abilities of, you know, somebody who wants to make a career in supply chain management? Do you think there is something specific in terms of the personality, the characteristics that this person should have if they were to succeed?
Yeah, so as supply chain evolves, you know, with the evolution of businesses, supply chain professionals also have to continuously evolve, and they've got to develop skill sets as they grow in their career. However, in my view, there are four main skill sets that are required irrespective of whichever stage they're in. These are, number one is knowledge and execution. You must be seen as a subject matter expert, and you should be able to execute well enough. When I say execute, do the basics right. Make sure that you do what you say, right? And you build up your reputation of being a very dependable supply chain professional. Collaboration is important. A lot of people, because supply chain traditionally tends to work a lot in the background, and it's a function that I always say influences a lot more than it controls, right? So learn to collaborate well with all stakeholders. And, you know, because supply chain people, I compare supply chain to the central nervous system. We talk to finance people, we talk to IT people, we talk to quality, we talk to safety, we talk to sales, we talk to manufacturing, you know, and we take so many bits of information from all these functions. And if you're a good dot connector, right, then you'll be able to connect the dots, and you can add a lot of value to the company. So, and of course, that eventually also helps your career. The more value you add to the company, the more visibility you get in your career and the faster you grow. So collaboration is very important. The next thing is communication. Be a good and effective communicator. Good communicators collaborate well, and they also influence decisions better than someone who can't communicate well. So be a good and effective communicator. Now, people might think, well, I can't really communicate well. It's true. I mean, not everybody is born with the gift of the gab, but there are courses out there, there are training programs to help you communicate better. And frankly, better communication just comes from just doing it, right? You just start off, you learn from your mistakes, and you just get better at it.
Yeah, it's a skill. Essentially, anything that's a skill can be learned. So
exactly, right? And the other one is customer focus. I had a manager in Nalco who told me that good supply chain exists to ensure that the business delivers on its commitment to the customers, right? So it's easy to get lost in the world of metrics and KPIs and supply chain because there's so much data. And if you like numbers, you know, you get lost in those numbers and metrics and all that, but don't, and then lose customer focus. So it's always important to keep the customer front and center of your supply chain. What I mean by that, what does the customer want? So if this is what customer wants, then how do you tailor, are our processes aligned with the needs of the customer? There is no point in measuring something or having a rigid process that does not help the customer get what they want, right? Or so essentially then the supply chain is failing the business, which is not ideal, which is not what we want. So keep the customer front and center, work your processes based on what the customer wants, and then, you know, you will always have that customer focus. Yeah. So the requirements of the skills will naturally be different depending on what stage of their career they are in. If someone's an entry-level job in supply chain, I would say focus on excellence, do the basics right, pick up the bits of collaboration, improve your communication, and also keep the customer focus. As you grow, you know, try to develop the eye for strategy, hone your strategic thinking skills. Ideally, at this time, it would be an expert in hard skills, and, you know, so build on the soft skills, right? Understand how supply chain influences all the other functions and so on and so forth, and continue to collaborate more, right? Of course, when you reach leadership roles, most likely you would have mastered, if not all of the four skills, some of the four skills, or you've been very close to mastery, right? And the focus will be on general leadership skills, such as strategic thinking, people management, and so on. Yeah.
We are almost out of time, Sharad. In closing, what would you want the listeners to take away from the conversation today?
Now, look, when I first started in supply chain, people asked, what is supply chain? Now, everybody knows what supply chain is. And what has not changed, that's a big change, but what has not changed is that supply chain has always been an exciting career. There is never a dull moment. You know, if you have the drive and passion to work in unpredictable environments, well, sometimes it can be predictable, but there will always be an unpredictable moment. And you love the buzz of operations, it can be an exciting career. For many years, it was the unglamorous cousin of sales and finance or marketing, for example, because that usually attracted people who said, I want to be in sales, I want to be in finance, I want to do marketing. But there are very few people say, hey, I love supply chain. But now people are, you know, as I probably think that's the reason why I'm on this podcast, right? So people are thinking, you know, what's supply chain? How can I make it a career? Yeah. People thought supply chain was just something that a function that just moves things from A to B. But the last 3 years have made it more glamorous. So, and a lot of companies are also created C-suite roles for supply chains, you know, VPs and so on, reporting directly to the CEO. So the profile has definitely increased. So it can be a very exciting career if you have the passion for it. Yeah. And even if you don't, if you dive into supply chain, and if you don't, if you think that's not your cup of tea, I can tell you that if you spend the few years you spend in supply chain, you will learn a lot. Yeah. So the profile has increased. So I hope it stays that way.
Wonderful. Thank you for your time, Sharath. It's been really informative. It's been insightful. Thank you for this wonderful chat.
Thanks, Ruchira, for inviting me onto this podcast. My pleasure. And thank you again. I really enjoyed the time on this podcast.